This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because I get to talk to Dr. Maggie Hennefeld about her book titled Death by Laughter, Female Hysteria and Early Cinema, published by Columbia University Press. It turns out, I admit I was not aware of this, that there was a time in which there were concerns that women could watch films and be so overwhelmed by how funny they were that they could literally die from laughing. Just from that bit of information alone, obviously someone had to investigate, and I'm very pleased that Maggie has done so and come to tell us all about it. Maggie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you please introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
That is a wonderful question, and I love your preface to the book. That's beautiful. So my name is Maggie Hennefeld. I am an associate professor of cultural studies and comparative literature at the University of Minnesota, and my research interests focus on silent film, archival film history and curating, and laughter, comedy, and the relation to gender and feminism. So I decided to write this book in 2014, Miranda. So pretty much a decade in the making. I've spent a decade of my life poring over obituaries for women who allegedly died from laughing too hard. And the idea came to me when I was doing a postdoc at the University of Toronto. I was participating in a seminar themed on humor, play, and games, an appropriate topic for me. And I was working on adapting my dissertation project into a book manuscript to submit to university presses. So that book came out in 2018. It's called Specters of Slapstick and Silent Film Comedians. And it's more focused on women's participation in genres of comedy in early 20th century cinema, slapstick comedy in particular. And I wanted to have a chapter in that book on women's laughter at the movies in the early 20th century, which just sounded like the most raucous, invigorating, wild and crazy social space imaginable. Like, I wanted to understand what it felt like to be a female laughing spectator in an early 20th century moving picture show. So I was doing a lot of archival research, including through digital databases like the Media History Digital Library. They have a search platform called Lantern and the World Newspaper Archive. And I was just doing kind of zany permutations of the same keyword search, like woman's laughter, she laughed herself, you know, like playing around with different keywords. And that's when I found my first obituary from 1908 about a woman who laughed for 8 hours without stopping at a humorous remark about dentistry. I reveal the punchline to the joke in chapter 2 of the book. And then I continued apace and I started finding these obituaries like, woman went to a comedy, ended up furnishing a tragedy because she laughed herself to death, you know, a vaudeville show. And first of all, I couldn't believe it. Like, is, you know, my first thought as an author was, is this real? Can this actually happen? Why are these obituaries kind of proliferating around the same time that cinema is being invented and emerging as a universally popular medium, especially for women? And so I started poking around the archive and sleuthing out these obituaries. And clearly, like, this was not to be contained in the first book. It morphed into a kind of behemoth second monograph of its own. But I found hundreds and hundreds of these obituaries and started thinking about them in the context of the social politics of women's laughter in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And the relationship between comedic laughter and laughter as a symptom of madness and female hysteria, you know, the trope of the laughing mad woman, and just kind of thinking about how these intersections between comedic laughter and female hysteria related to the kind of rise and popular emergence of early cinema as a sort of laughing gas factory, as Anca Parvulescu has called it. So that's the origin story. And then 10 years later, I guess here we are.
Well, the origin story, as well as a really helpful overview of a lot of what the book does. So thank you for framing our conversation very nicely there. Mm. I'd like to talk a little bit more, I suppose, about kind of the stay in this behind the scenes aspect of how you put this book together before we get into kind of some of the things you found. You talk about using this book as, quote, an experiment to embrace laughter on its own terms. This is a really intriguing proposition. Can you explain a bit what you mean by it?
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you for pointing me toward that formulation. I believe that I use that phrase in the introduction in a section called Laughter Without Comedy. Laughter above comedy is one of the rallying cries of the project as a whole. So I'm really interested in laughter that's sort of written off as disproportionate, unmotivated, like laughing too hard at a joke that isn't even funny in the first place, because that's sort of how women's laughter appears in these obituaries. Like, what, she laughed herself to death? How does that even happen? And so I'm thinking about that. I've been thinking about that a lot in relation to the politics of laughter and comedy in our present moment, the kind of, I don't know, we might even paraphrase it as a mass hysteria about political correctness in comedy, cancel culture, when it's okay to laugh at a joke, when it's monstrous and unethical to laugh at a joke. Like, we're constantly talking about laughter in these terms, when laughter should be self-censored, laughter as a mere kind of amplification of the content of comedy itself, a referendum on the appropriateness or inappropriateness of humor. So I kind of see laughter, embracing laughter on its own terms as a way out of this trap, the kind of hysteria over political correctness and cancel war culture. What does laughter mean in the absence of comedy, or what remains of the laughter that can't be resolved through a mere kind of analysis of the joke or dissection of the gag? I think there's real utopian potential in that kind of laughter that becomes irresistibly contagious, that spreads through your whole body, and has a meaning that can't quite be articulated in language, not even through the kind of darkest recesses of Black humor or the macabre. So I'm after that, those kind of utopian collectivizing potentials of laughter, when laughter becomes contagious and when it builds community beyond identity, beyond in-jokes, and beyond all of these sort of hot-button culture wars about, you know, whether comedy is punching up or punching down. But I primarily engage with that laughter beyond comedy through the archive, though everything I'm finding in the archive in this book, I really try to frame with an eye toward the present.
Hmm. All right. That's also, I think, really helpful to allow us to get into this discussion then. So thank you for taking us through sort of how you approach the topic. I want to pick up on the point you made earlier about kind of not just these obituaries and sort of what's happening, but that poking at this takes us into this socio-political context to understand kind of how these are even relevant in the first place. And I was fascinated to read that our current conceptions of hysterical laughter aren't actually what they were at this point. So what did hysterical laughter mean then? before it was something that was about finding something funny or enjoyable.
Right. Yeah. So this is the focus of the first chapter of my book. I can never Hysterical Laughter on the Brink of Enjoyment. That's chapter one. And so the sort of colloquialism or even euphemism to laugh hysterically, that was in no way associated with comedy or even enjoyment and pleasure until the very end of the 19th century, actually right around the invention and explosion of cinema and mass entertainment culture. In the mid-19th century, to laugh hysterically meant to suffer incredibly. Hysterical laughter was really the last thing you would ever want to experience with your body. It was something that primarily afflicted women, emotional women, kind of on the cusp of a nervous breakdown. And it was precipitated above all by the eruption of mixed feelings. So emotional, nervous, overwrought women laughed hysterically as a result of their unresolvable ambivalence. Like think of desire, lust, arousal, coupled with shame and grief and self-censorship or ambition and frustration. It was something that afflicted ambitious women who didn't really have social outlets for their desires and ideas. So this was the kind of notion of hysterical laughter in the mid-19th century. It was a trope of women's literature, particularly popular sensation novels like Lady Audley's Secret and The Women in White, but women's sentimental literature at large. To laugh hysterically was not necessarily a medical symptom of hysteria, but it was an indication of madness, and it was torturous. It was like, it was really the opposite of enjoyable. But then, so I started to do a kind of etymology of this phrase, hysterical laughter. When did it become associated with enjoyment and pleasure? And this also involved a bit of archival rag picking, some digital keyword sleuthing, which I was already doing anyway in tandem with trying to find more and more of these death by laughter obituaries. And I start to see glimmers of enjoyment around the 1870s, 1880s, mostly in the context of collective laughter in mass entertainment culture, like the audience laughed itself sick at a vaudeville show. The audience was overcome by gut-busting, hysterical laughter, you know, these sort of hyperbolic descriptions of laughter in that vein. But it really wasn't until the 1890s that hysterical laughter attained a kind of dominant connotation of pleasure and enjoyment, raucous exuberance. So cinema was invented in 1894 with these kinetoscope, you know, kind of peephole screenings in pleasure arcades. The first collective a public exhibition of cinema happened in late 1895. So really, like, you know, it's almost too much to think of as a historical coincidence, right? The sanctioning of hysterical laughter on the altar of pleasure and the historical emergence of moving pictures and popularity of cinema. So that's how I sort of relate these two things in the book.
So in this context then of each of these aspects individually, and especially as you've just said, their relation, why were there so many obituaries of women claiming that women had died from laughter at exactly this point?
Because women were having so much fun, right? Like all of these new pleasure spheres in movie theaters and beyond them, vaudeville, the amusement park, the electric carnival, like modern commercial culture needed women's exuberant laughter and pleasure because they were the primary consumers. And the old guard freaked out, right? The patriarchal old guard did not want women to be like laughing their heads off in all of these public spaces. They wanted women to go back to the doing housework and being domestic angels inside of the home. So first of all, I'll just say, if I haven't mentioned this yet, I'm not convinced that a single one of these women actually died from laughter. We can get into the nitty gritty of the obituaries in just a moment, but I read them. I view these obituaries in the book as a kind of symptom of moral panic about just how much fun women were having volubly, publicly, ostentatiously in public around the turn of the century. It's, you know, sexist backlash and moral panic. It's as simple as that. I mean, it's more complicated, or at least I find ways to overcomplicate it in the book. But that's the primary context in which I understand these obituaries.
And so then when do they stop, these obituaries stop appearing? Why do you think it's at this moment that they stop?
So I've lost count of exactly how many obituaries I'd found, well over 100, and they appeared over the course of half a century, from around the 1870s is when they first begin to materialize. And then by around World War I, the late 19-teens, the early 1920s, that's when they just sort of disappear, vanish off the face of the earth, or are no longer kind of perceived as sensational as a discourse. And I'll say just a couple other things about the obituaries themselves. First of all, they're often quite glib. Like, they're often mocking women for having given up the ghost to such a ludicrous cause of death, right? Like, you know, making sort of cheeky little asides, like the joke itself is censored from the obituary due to concerns about public safety. So that kind of raises an eyebrow. Like, if this obituary is real, why is the obituarist making fun of the deceased for, you know, actually like enjoying herself on the way out? Sometimes more kind of direct causes of death are cited in the obituary, like cardiac arrest, asphyxiation, a brain aneurysm kind of triggered to the point of medical crisis due to excess cachinnation, cachinnation being a commonly used word for laughter, particularly gendered laughter at the time. And another really important thing to keep in mind is that tight-laced corsetry was really popular, right? Fashionable women, the woman at that, you know, upscale vaudeville house in Connecticut who laughed herself to death at a comedy, this woman was no doubt wearing a tight corset. And I don't know, just like, Miranda, listener, try to imagine yourself laughing hysterically in a whalebone corset. Like, I think at the very least that would be extremely uncomfortable physiologically, if not, you know, anatomically hazardous to laugh while wearing a whalebone corset. So I don't think women actually died from laughing too hard, but if they did, it was almost certainly because of tight-laced corsetry and not because they like couldn't survive the ravages of their own pleasure. So around World War I, there are a number of things happening. First of all, the U.S. War Industries Board issued a proclamation in 1917 banning the corset to free up metal for military production. So if there is any physiological basis to death by laughter related to corsetry, that ban on the corset, which subsequently went out of fashion shortly after the war, could have been related. Laughing gas itself was weaponized as a lethal gas on the battlefield in Germany and France. So maybe there was something a little bit too ghoulish when, you know, people were literally dying of weaponized laughter overseas that made the, you know, these obituaries just like a little bit beyond the pale. And, you know, cultural sensibilities were changing after the war. We have the jazz age with the figure of the footloose flapper, the deadly vamp. So it's just, I don't know, like women's pleasure was becoming stylish in a way that was maybe more like universally palatable, even to the kind of patriarchal old guard, right? Like the flapper could laugh herself to, you know, could laugh as hard as she wanted. And it wasn't seen as, I don't know, as disruptive or perverse or disturbing for kind of traditional social mores. But then I did start finding a few more obituaries in the 1930s around the Great Depression, which, you know, re-inaugurated this sense of moral crisis regarding pleasure and enjoyment and their effects on the, you know, the economy after the stock market crash.
So really interesting to see how these kind of ups and downs in other parts of society impact this as well. Can I ask about a particular group of people at the beginning of the 20th century? This is also when we see, in some senses, the rise of psychology as a thing that's kind of going on and becoming popular. What did psychologists think about hysteria and female laughter?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Wow, I'm like overwhelmed. I don't know where to begin. I have so many thoughts. So I guess the midsection of the book is on female hysteria. The title was originally Death by Laughter, comma, Female Hysteria, comma, you know, and Early Cinema, because the book is divvied up as such. The first section is on the history of women's laughter, the midsection is on female hysteria, and then the last part, we finally get to cinema. But my editor, and I think he was right, like wanted the death by laughter part to be more prominent because it's so like, you know, head scratching, like, what? Is that real? So even before the early 20th century, but around the time that these death by laughter obituaries were starting to appear, in like the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, the representation of female hysteria becomes also a staple of mass entertainment culture. In France in particular, the public was absolutely obsessed with the kind of sideshow of female hysteria around the end of the 19th century. And a lot of this had to do with the neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot, who was the head of the neurology ward at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris. So he gave weekly lectures in this amphitheater that seated 400 spectators at the Salpêtrière Hospital. Freud attended these lectures. A lot of, you know, medical students and physicians attended them, but also members of the public. You know, tourists would see Charcot's Salpêtrière hysteria lectures as like an absolute must on their visit to Paris. So these lectures were open to the public. And Charcot, it was really kind of cruel, actually, his praxis. He took hysteria very seriously. Part of the reason that hysteria was so fascinating is because, you know, hysterics had symptoms with seemingly no organic basis in the body. Hysteria, in a sense, it's a somatic disorder. It's a conversion disorder, but it's also an affliction in which the mind itself becomes the body, and it can produce symptoms ranging from, you know, uncontrollable epilepsy, delusions, hallucinations, to, unmotivated laughter, or, you know, compulsive hiccuping and tongue clacking noises, right? These bizarre, jarring somatic symptoms with seemingly no physical basis in the body because, you know, they're psychiatric in nature. So Charcot would hypnotize women. His star patient Blanche Whitman was known as the queen of the hysterics, and she was widely photographed, sketched, impersonated in the music hall in vaudeville and the Grand Guignol. The actress Sarah Bernhardt even attended Charcot's lectures in training for her role in Adrienne Lecouvreur in the early 1880s. So it was like, you know, Charcot would induce epileptic seizures. He would tell these women to imagine themselves metamorphosing into other species, like a pigeon or an ostrich. He would have them assume impossible acrobatic positions for hours on end. That's how he could kind of suss out whether they were faking. Some of these phases of the induced hysteric epileptic attack that he would provoke through hypnosis, he referred to as clownism, because the hysterics poses he compared to the like trapeze act of a circus clown, like just like unbelievable feats of the body. Charcot is sort of parading on stage. So, right, like, oh my God, these poor women. But no wonder the public became totally fascinated and obsessed with hysteria, because it was exploited as such. And in fact, some of the women from his medical ward after his death then went on to seek gainful employment in the circus and the carnival. And beyond Paris, like around the world, you know, people were well aware of Charcot's experiments. After Charcot's practice of hypnosis was kind of debunked and in a way replaced by psychoanalysis, you know, Freud viewed hysteria as a symptom of repressed memories, reminiscences that were sexual in nature. This is sort of the thesis of his case studies that he co-authored with Joseph Breuer, who also attended Charcot's lectures in the late 19th century. But whereas Charcot's kind of understanding of hysteria was visual in nature, right? He's staging these mass spectacles. For Freud, it's all about talking. So Freud believed that putting repressed, impossible memories back into language, taking them out of the body and putting them onto the tongue, into words, into text, that was the cure to hysteria. And I don't know, you asked about the early 20th century. It was still a kind of international cultural fixation. We see hysteria widely kind of exploited and represented in cinema and vaudeville and literature. There was an entire field of nervousness studies in the US, in Britain. You know, Virginia Woolf was famously prescribed the rest cure for her neurasthenia. Neurasthenia being a more kind of neurotic and diffuse, not necessarily medicalizable condition of hysteria, sort of, an amorphous affliction that a lot of the population suffered from because of the hyperstimulations of modern mass culture, right? Street traffic, the noise, the railroad, all of these unruly public spaces of transportation and a visual spectacle made the public incredibly nervous, in addition to the kind of grueling labor being performed in the factory and sweatshops. Everyone suffered from the disease of nervousness, if not full-on medical hysteria.
Thank you for adding that strand into this. I think it really adds a lot of interest to kind of our thoughts on early psychology and questions about hysteria and gender. Mm-hmm. So can we continue bringing all these things together? You talked about the three sections of the book, female laughter, hysteria, and then early cinema. Can we put them all together? How was female laughter and female hysteria depicted in early cinema? And why do you think it was shown in the way it was?
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, it was ubiquitous in early cinema, female laughter and hysteria, and, you know, both things at once. The last chapter of my book is about close-ups of women laughing hysterically directly at the spectator into the camera at the end of the film, which was a popular convention to end a film with just an image of women's explosive, exuberant laughter, really after the film itself had ended. And early cinema was such a visual medium. In the 1890s and early 1900s, Tom Gunning refers to this paradigm of cinema as the cinema of attractions, where storytelling, narrative are not the point, right? Creating this kind of self-contained narrative universe that the spectator disappears into, that was not the point of cinema at the time. It was an incredibly exhibitionist medium. One of the earliest films made in 1894, Record of a Sneeze, it merely consists of a close-up of a man sneezing into the camera, and then the film is over. It's called Fred Ott's Sneeze. So I think, like, because film was such a visual medium, and it was all about exhibitionism, right? The kind of miracle of the representability of movement itself, any kind of explosive, delightful, contagious gesture of the body, like that's what spectators were flocking to the moving picture houses, to the vaudeville theaters to see. That's what producers were churning out. So it was just sort of, hysterical laughter, hysterical gesture, the visibility of laughter and enjoyment. This was more than a trope. This was the lifeblood. This was the bread and butter of early film representation in the very earliest years of the medium.
Mm. So that obviously answers why you investigate it as you do in the book. But I wanted to ask, because you did bring it up, the final chapter focuses, even within this, specifically on female facial close-ups. Mm-hmm. What are you doing with that focus on this particular aspect of what you've just described?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I feel like we've skipped ahead. I've already gotten us out of order.
That's fine. We're good.
So yeah, the last section of the book, I guess I already mentioned this, is on early cinema. We finally arrive at the screen in chapter 7, a couple hundred pages into the book itself. Chapter 7 is on women's laughing spectatorship. Chapter 8, maybe we can circle back to in a bit, is about the use of moving pictures in early 20th century American mental asylums. Mm-hmm. Chapter 9, we at last arrive at the surface of the screen itself, right? It's a little bit tantalizing to have early cinema in the title and then not really talk, or at least not focus on visual representations in cinema until the very last chapter of the book. But in the very earliest film, in the very earliest years where, you know, some films were really just a few seconds long, there was a popular genre known as the facial. And it was kind of precisely what it would appear based on the description, the facial, just a short film of an actor or performer making silly facial expressions, sneezing, yawning, laughing, having a tooth extracted. It was like very wild and woolly. But part of the appeal of the facial, in addition to, you know, like it's kind of amusing to see people grimacing in front of the camera, is that their own sort of like gestural spasms would become contagious to the spectator, right? So in this sort of life world where everyone's nervous, everyone is sort of like on the brink of hysterical madness, there's a kind of catharsis in catching hysteria contagiously from the pleasurable dexterity of ventriloquists and pantomime performers who you're going to the theater to watch, you know, do all of these sort of like a wily but controlled spasms in front of the lens. So I think audiences are flocking to cinema to see these facials in part because, it's cathartic to have a sanctioned space in which to sort of exhibit the symptoms that you're like trying to suppress in your ordinary life. But what happened to these facials as films are becoming slightly longer, cinema is being used more for the purpose of storytelling and not for just representing some a parade or a butterfly dancer or a man sneezing, is that the facial becomes obsolete as a genre itself, but it persists as what film historians refer to as an emblematic shot. So this is kind of the film actor taking a bow before the audience, sometimes at the beginning, usually at the end of the film. So there's a film from 1914 called Daisy Doodad's Dial, in which a woman named Daisy Doodad, who's played by the brilliant actress Florence Turner, who was herself a filmmaker, a screenwriter, and a producer, she plays a character named Daisy Doodad, who's training day and night to compete in an amateur face-making competition, right? Gurning was actually a competitive sport in the UK at the time. There were like national gurning or face-pulling competitions. And at the very end of the film, Daisy is haunted by floating specters of her own hysterical face making that sort of float over her body while she's sleeping. But then at the very, very end of the film, there's an extreme close-up of the actress, not the character, but the actress Florence Turner, continuing to run through these grimaces. So that's how films themselves would end. So I really view women's close-ups in which they're sort of alternating between, uncanny, disturbing, and pleasurable, amusing facial gestures. Like, this is what sort of bridges the gap between the narrative enclosure of the film and the life world of the audience, the emblematic shot. And that itself became kind of obsolete around the mid-19-teens, around the solidification of like what film historians call the kind of classical narrative paradigm, like a far cry from the cinema of attractions, and around when we stop seeing all of these death by laughter obituaries. So that's why I kind of circumscribe the chronology of the book as I do.
No, thank you for taking us through that. I think it's, again, really interesting on multiple levels and ties so many things together. But we do, of course, have to go back to the psychiatric hospitals aspect. Don't worry, I had not forgotten. So now that we have a better idea of what is actually in these films, what they look like, why were they being used in psychiatric hospitals? How were they being used? What does this tell us about this bigger topic of kind of women and when and how they should be laughing?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And yet again, I don't know where to begin. I'm still kind of wrestling with what you know, the projection of cinema as a universal cure to madness, which is how it was promoted, with why all of these movie theaters were being built in American mental asylums in the early 20th century. I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of self-explanatory, you know, life in these asylums was extremely tedious and grim. And if there's any emotional basis to neurodivergence, like any form of recreation or pleasure itself could be therapeutic. But the claims of the film industry and of professional psychiatry went well beyond the sort of mere concept of cinema as a cathartic form of distraction or entertainment or emotional relief. In fact, the U.S. federal government earmarked hundreds of thousands of dollars in the first decades of the 20th century to build motion picture theaters and install projectors in U.S. mental asylums, part of the context for this belief in cinema, or at least we might say promotion of cinema as a universal cure to blanket neurodivergence, is that you know, there were scandals upon scandals, exposés by reformists who were demanding more humane conditions in U.S. mental asylums at the time, which suffered from overcrowding, abuse, dehumanization. So this idea, oh, we'll just build movie theaters, right? Like, patients suffering from melancholia, their mood will be lifted. Patients suffering from motion disorders, gait disorders, will be like so encouraged by, I don't know, watching slapstick comedies, which, you know, slapstick in a way is all about the kind of cathartic spectacle of spastic, undisciplined, ungoverned physical movement, right? Like they're in a way like patients with, I don't know, suffering from motion disorders or delusional hallucinations as they were sort of medicalized at the time. Like they saw their mirror image in the slapstick comedy genre. So I think there was a kind of, I don't know, under-theorized, maybe cynical belief in slapstick as a sort of mirror reflection of crises of neurodivergence that could have a kind of cathartic or therapeutic function. But I think the aims of the so-called visual cure of moving pictures were much more expedient and even cynical than that. Like, I don't know to what extent psychiatrists who became ambassadors for the movie cure actually believed in its utility. Like, it was merely expedient, but it was also very real. I started researching it. You know, I want to give a shout out to the Media History Digital Library that had run by Eric Hoyt out of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Their search platform Lantern has digitized thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of trade journals, motion picture magazines from the time, which I used extensively. These are the archives I drew on in researching these chapters, because it was not so much in like psychological case studies where I was reading about the moving picture cure, but in culture magazines or film entertainment magazines like the Nickelodeon and the Moving Picture World. But I also found archival evidence through the World Newspaper Archive that these theaters were being built, and psychologists and neurologists were stumping for showing patients in asylum slapstick comedies in particular. Like that would seem to be the most therapeutic of all possible genres. And I tried to reach out to some of these asylums have been renamed, you know, like the kind of ableist language in the archive, like needs to be read in the book, like with a massive trigger warning. I tried reaching out to them to get more information, like did these screenings actually happen? Were they gender segregated? You know, did like women and men in the institution have separate screenings? Were they racially segregated? What films, you know, actually played, were included? And I came up short. They like, These archives weren't preserved if they were ever recorded in the first place, and institutions were very guarded about the information that they would share with me, even when I, you know, told them it was for research purposes, for a book that I'm writing. But yeah, it's really, really fascinating. And I don't know, when like the Nickelodeon would mention a specific film that, you know, like was allegedly therapeutic for patients, it would be something like the Unlucky Trousers, where a man keeps ripping and repairing and then ripping and repairing and then ripping his trousers. So like, I don't know, something about the sort of more emotional futility of conditions on the ground in these asylums, right? Like so bleak, and like no one would believe in the reality of the emotional suffering of the patient. Somehow that's brought to relief in a film like The Unlucky Trousers, where a man who rips his pants eventually throws up his hands. You know, it's just, you have to read it to believe it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't imagine watching a film like that in any circumstance, much less in these sorts of ones, and having any feeling other than just like, what is happening? Yeah, no, absolutely fascinating. Especially, I'm glad you mentioned the kind of bit about how you figured this out and the archival aspect of it all. Given that we've mentioned kind of a number of times this concern about female hysteria being such a part of medical debate, social debate, really in kind of all sorts of places, do you want to talk a bit more about that, but kind of in either in the context then or any connections you see with it after this time period, even all the way up to now?
So hysteria, fun fact, hysteria was not retired from the DSM until 1980, which is, I don't know, I think shocking. And now there are various placeholders for hysteria, both in psychiatry and in popular culture, like conversion disorder is a variant of hysteria, which was always viewed as a kind of conversion disorder, right? The mind becoming the body, somatic symptoms with no physiological basis. But also in popular films, I don't know, like the manic pixie dream girl, or I'm thinking of films like Single White Female, Basic Instinct, even The Black Swan. I feel like there are all these tropes of female madness and neurodivergence and nymphomania in popular genre cinema, in which women play neurodivergent characters who are sort of exploited in a similar vein that calls to mind how I see like hysterics being bandied about in the archives that I was researching for this book. But also, I don't know, like hysteria has made a comeback today for better and for worse. And by hysteria, I don't mean the medical diagnosis of hysteria, which, you know, like first emerged, right? Hysteria etymologically comes from the Greek word hystera, meaning uterus. And it was, you know, diagnosed as the symptom of a wandering uterus, like the womb wandering around the woman's body, particularly as a result of disuse. It afflicted spinsters and widows in particular, right? So obviously, like, hysteria is sexist, going back to the uterine etymology. But I mean hysteria as kind of a discourse or a trope. So, you know, I think like we quickly lose count of how often this notion of like, I don't know, like in the context of culture wars, the right accusing the left of collective hysteria, Bitcoin hysteria, cryptocurrency hysteria, Trumpist hysteria, cancel culture hysteria, right? It's often used dismissively as a kind of slur for just accusing the other of being irrational and over the top, right? Like in the context of some sort of like fad or dangerous obsession and fixation. So we see hysteria appear negatively in the rhetoric in kind of that vein as an insult against the other. But there's actually, and this is a really cool part of the book that I get into in particular in chapter 6 on mass hysteria and its relation to experimental art and kind of like feminist, the feminist avant-garde. A lot of contemporary artists, feminist artists, filmmakers, photographers, performers have been going back to Charcot's iconography from the Salpêtrière. Charcot, you know, had all of his patients photographed and drawing on the archive of hysterical gestures and reclaiming them. So this sort of reclaiming of hysteria goes back to second wave feminist theory. Hélène Cixous' Laugh of the Medusa, Juliette Mitchell's scholarship, Elaine Showalter's scholarship on female hysteria. Feminist theorists around the 1970s, 1980s started to recuperate 19th century heyday hysteria as a kind of proto-language for a kind of more explicit politics of feminist protest and activism and collective representation. And then hysteria sort of goes underground again around the millennium and Y2K, like when I was cutting my teeth on popular culture in the 1990s, it was maybe like less visible in the iconography. But in recent years, maybe around all of the sort of resurgence of moral panic and accusations of mass hysteria levied around, like, I don't know, sort of in response to Trumpism, climate catastrophe, neo-authoritarianism, hysteria is seen as like the only possible mode of representation for really getting at the madness of our own historical conjuncture. Like, how do you explain what's happening in our culture and politics today? It completely boggles the mind, right? It feels like the world is ending every second. Like, fascism is on the rise. We've trashed the planet. It feels like the world is ending. And yet, all the same, somehow it endures and continues. And that's what hysteria is, right? Hysteria is a language for the unrepresentable. So I think feminist artists and activists are returning to it in precisely that vein. And there are all of these feminist hysteria collectives in London, of course, in Vienna, in LA, in Tokyo. This intellectual and artist, Johanna Braun, who started an international project called The Hysteric as Conceptual Operator. And she's co-edited two recent volumes on hysteria and performance and popular representation, hysteria and intermediality in the arts, I believe both of which are open access. So it's also in response to the sort of hysterical zeitgeist today, not in the negative sense, but in the like awesome feminist reclamatory sense that I myself turn to these archives.
Wonderful. I was actually going to ask you a little bit about those collective aspects of it. So is there anything further you'd like to say about the kind of positive potential of crowd level, mass level hysterical laughter? We often think of kind of the whole crowd laughing together as being quite scary, as being about fear. But you've just given us some kind of mentions of collectives that are doing something else with it. Do you want to say anything else about the positive potential of laughing crowds?
Yeah, and thank you for that invitation. I would love nothing more than to say, that is actually one of my favorite topics. And it's the focus of chapter 6 on mass hysteria and affective contagion. And this goes back to what we were exploring in the beginning about the book's experiment to embrace laughter on its own terms, kind of the irresistible contagion of laughter beyond the sort of boundary keeping of the in-joke or the ways in which comedy itself is so based in identity and social recognition, right? Like, we laugh with our people and against the laughter of the other. So I'm interested in experiments, practices such as laughter yoga, experiments to provoke laughter out of nothing and then to spread it contagiously through the public sphere. So I open chapter 6 with a YouTube viral video called Lachen in der U-Bahn, Laughter on the U-Bahn, which is the underground train in Berlin. And, you know, you can find it on YouTube. I include the URL in my bibliography. It's a hilarious video. You can't watch it without laughing. I dare you to try. And it's mostly women who are on the underground train, and a couple people start laughing, and then other people are laughing at their laughter. And, you know, there's like a sort of arrogant looking teenager with a faux hawk, of course, a guy who looks resentful and doesn't succumb to the laughing contagion, but everyone catches the fou rire. And it's sort of I don't know, a euphoric experiment in contagious hysterical laughter in an enclosed public space. And like you say, not all group laughter is desirable or positive. You know, think about the kind of laughter that erupts at a Trump rally, often in response to misogynistic or white supremacist insult humor. I found, you know, just in my keyword searches and archival rag picking for collective laughter, found stories about the euphoric mob laughter on the scene of a lynching of a Black man. So obviously there are very disturbing implications of the mob psychology of collective contagious laughter. But I think there is a flip side of that. I think, you know, there are utopian possibilities of laughter beyond comedy, and laughter in the absence of comedy, just laughter spreading euphorically through the public body. And the German critical theorist Walter Benjamin, who, you know, committed suicide escaping the Nazis in the late 1930s, before the full-on rise of fascism, you know, before the Reichstag fire, wrote about laughter, about collective laughter, as an inoculation against mass psychosis, right? Like, because we're all losing our mind in response to the kind of horrific historical conditions and nervous overstimulations of our time of modern industrial culture. He saw the laughter provoked by grotesque slapstick comedies in particular, and Disney cartoons as provoking just a different sensation of laughter, a deeper laughter, a sort of darker laughter that in that sense could be a kind of inoculation against madness at large. Obviously, that's not really how, you know, the history of the early and mid 20th century panned out. I'm not super optimistic. You'd have to be a fool. You'd have to be hysterical to be optimistic about the future today. But I do see pockets and ripples of possibility that I associate with the pleasures of contagious laughter. And I do rogue experiments in my undergraduate classrooms. You know, I am mischievous enough to try to, you know, like spread laughter out of nothing in the public sphere in my own hometown, or now my hometown, Minneapolis. You know, no definitive conclusions as of yet, but I haven't lost steam. I haven't abandoned hope.
How intriguing. Thank you so much for kind of taking us through history, but also very much giving us something to kind of look out for wherever we might be about how this is all or developing now. Can I ask you to tell us one more thing about the future before I let you go? This has obviously been a project you've been passionate about for ages, and getting into the details of it, it's like, well, how could you not be intrigued? But the book is out. People can go read it. So, So is there anything you might be working on now that it's done, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic, that you'd like to preview?
Oh my God. I'm working on taking a break.
That's fair.
I mean, it's like for me, writing is a form of sublimation. I mean, we were kind of chatting before the interview and I was just marveling at how many of these New Books Network podcasts you've done. And you clearly, you know, despite the kind of telecommunicative mode through which we're conducting this interview, you are not phoning it in. Like, you've engaged with this book very deeply, and I'm so grateful. And as a lifelong slow reader myself, I'm so impressed by what a prolific reader you are and your attention to nuanced detail. So I just had to share that. But
thank you.
I don't know, I have a similar orientation to writing. I write a lot. I find writing cathartic and therapeutic. And I, you know, I'm like always eager to take on a new project, but I did promise my spouse that I'm not going to dive headlong into another monograph. This is my second monograph. Like, it's like this one, it's not a short book, though hopefully it's a fun ride, if nothing else. But I am, like, one thing that I'm getting really, really into and that I was working on in tandem with writing this book is archival film curating from the silent era and beyond. So my friends Laura Horak, Elif Rangan-Kainachi, and I just co-curated a 4-disc DVD Blu-ray set called Cinema's First Nasty Women. We actually did a podcast interview about it with Annie Burke for the New Books Network. That includes 99 feminist archival silent films through from the silent era that focus on slapstick comedy, queerness, and female-to-male cross-dressing in particular. It's out with Kino Lorber, but we've been curating a bunch of screenings for like repertory cinemas, film festivals, university cinemas, sourced from Cinema's First Nasty Women. So like almost all of the films that I write about in Chapter 9 about the facial close-up, most of those you can also watch in the Cinema's First Nasty Women collection. And my friend in Minneapolis, Michelle Baroudi, and I, we started a new organization called Archives on Screen, Twin Cities. And that's dedicated to curating rare, unseen, minoritized archival cinema from the silent era through world cinema, kind of political oppositional cinemas, obscure but beautiful cinemas, you know, like shit you're not going to watch in the multiplex or on Netflix, which has pretty much purged most of its silent cinema and archival cinema from the platform. You know, you can even search Netflix's database chronologically. Anyway, I digressed. We started Archives on Screen. We're doing a lot of repertory programming in the Twin Cities at the Film Society and our local rep theater, the Trilon. So that's really where my heart is right now and where my scholarship is going. Like, I'm really interested in curating archival cinema for publics and thinking about that. So I allegedly have a new book project because I had to write a grant proposal for funding. It's called 21st Century Silent Film Culture. And it's about not so much the historicity of silent era cinema, you know, from the early 20th century, but the revival of silent film cultures today, everything from the kind of rediscovery and restoration of long unseen silent films to like, you know, viral silent film memes, podcasts, fan communities, musical scoring, activist collectives that are engaged with silent film curating. Like, yeah, this is like my passion right now. And I'm repeating just like to remind myself as I do every 4 seconds, I am not working on another book, but this is what it would be about.
Well, that sounds like an incredibly cool project and exactly the reason that I say things like, is there something you're working on, even if it's not a book? because as much as I love books, not everything has to be a book. And there's so many cool things beyond that particular medium. So thank you very much for sharing what you're currently working on, because it does sound really cool. However, we have mainly been talking about a book. So in case someone wants to investigate that work and also read the book, I'll remind you of the title, listeners. The book we've been discussing is called Death by Laughter, Female Hysteria and Early Cinema, published by Columbia University Press. Maggie, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. It was my pleasure. I really appreciate it.